Mimi Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
What about the idea that we should think about democracy, think about the right of the people to elect candidates of their choice?
The reason we're here is that President Trump tried to disenfranchise 80 million Americans who voted against him, and the Constitution doesn't require that he be given another chance.
Can Donald Trump be barred from running for president for engaging in an insurrection? That's the case before the Supreme Court. We'll speak with the nation's justice correspondent, Ellie Mistel. Then, senior Biden administration officials traveled to Michigan to meet with Arab American and Muslim leaders about the war in Gaza.
Senior officials traveled to Michigan, and they are obviously traveling today to hear directly from the community, to hear directly from community leaders on a range of issues that are important to them, obviously, as well, not just them, but their families, including the conflict that we're currently seeing in Israel and Gaza.
We'll speak with Michigan's highest-ranking Arab or Muslim leader, Representative Abraham Ayash, who was at the meeting. And we'll speak with Palestinian-American community organizer Leila Al-Abid, who's spearheading a campaign urging people to vote for uncommitted in Michigan's upcoming primary. She's the sister of Michigan Congressmember Rashida Tlaib, the only Palestinian-American member of Congress. Then we go to Pakistan, where early election results show a tight race in an election marred by accusations of vote rigging. We'll get the latest. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Nermeen Sheikh. In southern Gaza, Israeli snipers gunned down at least 21 people in Khan Yunis as they tried to reach Nasser Hospital. Al Jazeera reports Israeli soldiers are, quote, shooting at every moving object near the hospital. In northern Gaza, the Al-Quds Hospital has been under fire from Israeli tanks. UNICEF has warned an escalation of Israel's attacks in Rafah will cause hunger and disease to skyrocket. Over half of Gaza's population of 2.3 million people have taken refuge in Rafah after Israel claimed it was a, quote, safe zone. There are more than 600,000 children in the area. Gaza is already experiencing the worst levels of child malnutrition in the world. This comes as a UN committee said it will review Israel's abuses of children's rights.
The rights of children living under the State of Israel's effective control are being gravely violated at a level that has rarely been seen in recent history.
In the Jabalia refugee camp, Gazans dug through rubble in a desperate search to find any source of water.
I don't know what to tell you. It's a hopeless situation. Instead of getting some rest, we dig under the rubble there. This water line, for your information, we dug it out from under the rubble. We kept digging until we found water. We're back to the Stone Age, 30, 40, 50,000 years ago. We dig water out, filter it from sand, and use it for cooking. We're asking all Arab countries and everyone to figure out a solution, because this is not a solution. We die every day, every minute, every second.
Meanwhile, the United Arab Emirates is hosting a meeting of Arab nations in a bid to prevent an escalation of a larger regional conflict. The family of two Palestinian-American brothers say the pair, their Canadian father, and three other relatives have been detained after an Israeli raid on their home in Gaza. The brothers, Borak and Hashim Al-Agha, are aged 18 and 20. National Security spokesperson John Kirby says the U.S. will talk to Israel about the detention of the brothers, as well as Samahir Ismail, a Palestinian-American woman from Louisiana, who was forcibly taken by Israeli soldiers in the occupied West Bank earlier this week. Meanwhile, in the United States, Texas police say the Sunday stabbing in Austin of 23-year-old Palestinian-American Zakaria Dwar was a hate crime. The Senate voted to advance a $95 billion military funding package for Ukraine, Israel, and Taiwan. The measure was stripped of border provisions after Republicans rejected an earlier bill that included an immigration crackdown that they themselves had demanded. Senators will now consider sending an additional $60 billion to Ukraine and $14 billion to Israel. In Illinois, prosecutors have dropped criminal charges against two Northwestern University students who published a mock school newspaper accusing Northwestern of being complicit in the genocide of Palestinians. The reversal comes after the parent company of the Daily Northwestern faced condemnation and the threats to boycott the paper. In labor news, the AFL-CIO has joined other unions in calling for a ceasefire in Gaza. The AFL-CIO is the largest federation of labor unions in the U.S., representing some 12.5 million people. The special counsel investigating Joe Biden's handling of classified documents after his vice presidency has declined to charge Biden, despite finding the president, quote, willfully retained and disclosed classified materials. In his report, special counsel Robert Hur said a jury would be sympathetic to Biden and would view him as a, quote, well-meaning elderly man with a poor memory. Hur made several other references to Biden's memory, which he called significantly limited. Biden later responded to questions about Hur's comments.
My memory is fine. My memory, take a look at what I've done since I've become president. None of you thought I could pass any of the things I got passed. How'd that happen? You know, I guess I just forgot what was going on.
Later, in the same news conference, Biden mistakenly referred to Egypt's Abdel Fattah al-Sisi as the president of Mexico. The Supreme Court appears poised to overturn Colorado's ruling, which disqualified Trump from the primary ballot for engaging in an insurrection. Both liberal and conservative justices expressed skepticism over Colorado's case. This is Justice Sonia Sotomayor.
I think that the question that you have to confront is why a single state should decide who gets to be president of the United States. In other words, you know, this question of whether a former president is disqualified for insurrection to be president again is, you know, you just say it. It sounds awfully national to me. So whatever means there are to enforce it would suggest that they have to be federal, national means.
The Supreme Court's decision, expected in the coming weeks, will likely apply to any other state where efforts are underway to remove Trump from the ballot, such as Maine. In other primary news, on Thursday, Trump won the Republican primary caucuses in Nevada and the U.S. Virgin Islands. Nevada also held its Democratic caucus, which Biden won. In more election news, the Federal Communications Commission has banned AI-generated robocalls. In Pakistan, early results of Thursday's parliamentary election show independent candidates affiliated with jailed former Prime Minister Imran Khan in the lead. Cell phone and internet services were cut off just as voting began, which opposition candidates denounced as another move by Pakistan's military-backed interim government to rig the election. We'll go to Pakistan for more later in the broadcast. Russia's election commission has barred anti-war Putin challenger Boris Nadezhdin from running in next month's presidential election. Authorities claimed around 15% of the signatures he collected for his candidate application were invalid, putting him below the threshold for qualification. Although President Vladimir Putin is widely expected to win the election, Nadezhdin has emerged as the opposition's best shot. He's vowed to challenge his disqualification all the way to Russia's Supreme Court.
You can take me off the elections. Okay, you can. But what will they do with the millions waiting for changes who disagree with the course the country is going? That's the problem. These people are not going anywhere. I will continue working further. We will be moving candidates for elections. We will be organizing a widespread movement.
Brazil's federal police has confiscated former President Jair Bolsonaro's passport as he faces accusations of plotting a military coup to overturn his election loss to Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva in 2022. Federal agents carried out 33 searches and 4 arrests tied to the case Thursday. Bolsonaro and his allies are accused of spreading disinformation about voter fraud, recruiting military officials to support a coup, and encouraging far-right protesters to storm government buildings to prevent Lula from taking office. In Haiti, police killed five environmental protection agents Wednesday amid escalating protests demanding the resignation of Prime Minister Ariel Henry and an end to gang violence. Haitian police claimed the environmental agents opened fire first. Clashes were also reported throughout the capital, Port-au-Prince, with police firing tear gas and live bullets at protesters.
We have no set course. We are on the streets until we succeed in uprooting these gangs at the head of state.
U.S.-backed Prime Minister Henri became the de facto ruler following the assassination of Haitian President Jovenel Moïse in 2021. According to a 2022 agreement, Henri was supposed to hold elections and hand over power to the winner this week. But the elections were not held as planned, as Henri claimed he would schedule them only after the country's security situation improves. The UN is appealing for over $4 billion in aid for Sudan, which is facing some of the world's worst internal displacement and hunger crises after months of fighting between the Sudanese army and the paramilitary rapid support forces. This is UN aid chief Martin Griffiths.
There is a certain kind of obscenity about the humanitarian world, which is the competition for suffering. A competition between places. I have more suffering than you, so I need to get more attention, so I need to get more money. But I don't think there's anywhere quite so tragic in the world today as Sudan.
The World Food Programme warned last week Sudanese people are dying of starvation as the conflict has cut off many people from accessing aid. This comes as 13 Sudanese asylum seekers died after their boat capsized off Tunisia's coast Wednesday. 27 other passengers were missing as of Thursday. The International Organization for Migration found more than 3,000 people drowned in the Mediterranean Sea while attempting to cross to Europe in 2023. And in related news, a Greek court has acquitted 16 humanitarian workers who helped rescue refugees in the Mediterranean in 2015 and 2016. They'd been accused of espionage and other charges in what has been condemned as the criminalization of humanitarian work. But the aid workers are not in the clear yet, as they still face a separate felony trial with charges including facilitating illegal immigration and money laundering. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Nermeen Sheikh, joined by Amy Goodman. Hi, Amy.
Hi, Nermeen, and welcome to our listeners and viewers around the country and around the world.
Senior Biden administration officials traveled to Michigan on Thursday to meet with Arab American and Muslim leaders amid growing opposition to Biden's candidacy over his support for Israel's assault on Gaza. Michigan, which is an important swing state, is also home to the largest percentage of Arab Americans in the United States. Biden's campaign manager traveled to Detroit last month, but a number of Arab American leaders and elected officials declined to meet with her over the war in Gaza. Last week, Biden traveled to Michigan himself to meet with members of the United Auto Workers Union, who endorsed him, but he did not meet with any Arab American leaders. White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre responded to a question about the meetings in Michigan at a news conference yesterday.
Senior officials traveled to Michigan, and they are obviously traveling today to hear directly from the community, to hear directly from community leaders on a range of issues that are important to them, obviously, as well, not just them, but their families, including the conflict that we're currently seeing in Israel and Gaza. This is a private meeting. We want to give them the space to have a meeting that certainly has candor, certainly where both where we can hear directly from them. So don't want to get too far into what's going to be discussed, but we want to hear directly from them. We want to hear their concerns. We believe it's important for these leaders to be able to speak directly to officials in the White House.
Among the people who met with Biden administration officials yesterday was Michigan House Majority Floor Leader Abraham Ayash. He's the state's highest-ranking Arab or Muslim leader. Representative Ayash is among over 30 elected officials in Michigan who've signed on to a Listen to Michigan campaign and pledged to vote uncommitted in the state's primary on February 27th. Representative Ayash joins us now from Detroit. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Representative Ayash. If you could tell us who was present in this meeting and what were your demands to them?
Thank you for having me. There were several meetings throughout the day. We had folks from the National Security Council. Samantha Power was present, as well as other folks from the Biden administration and the State Department. And the conversations were very frank. I know many of us did not spare any time or word in terms of discussing what we need. And the conditions that we laid out are simple. We are expecting a permanent ceasefire. We want to see restrictions on and conditions on the military aid that Israel continues to receive right now without any conditions and without any restrictions or parameters. And we want to see a serious commitment for the humanitarian aid to be sent to Gaza, as well as reinstating the funding for UNRWA. So we were clear that unless these demands are going to be initiated, then we have no interest in continuing the conversations with the White House, because now is not the time for posturing. I would be remiss to not mention that this meeting happens 19 days before the presidential primary here in Michigan.
Let's talk about that, State Representative Ayash. And you're extremely significant as the number two person in the House in Michigan. And again, as Nermeen said, the highest ranking Arab American and Muslim leader in Michigan. This meeting where original meeting with the campaign manager for President Biden, you chose not to meet with her. He has sent out a whole group, including Samantha Power, former U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, now head of USAID, and Tom Perez, former labor secretary. This clearly has shaken the White House. The level of protests when he was getting the endorsement of the UAW, UAW workers holding up signs calling for a ceasefire. Talk about why you decided to have this meeting and not boycott the invite, and also what they had to say to you about where President Biden stands on a ceasefire.
So there was no direct commitment on the ceasefire, but what I will say is when they invited us to meet with the campaign manager, we rejected it because this is not the time to engage on electoral politics, particularly when you see 30,000 innocent folks that have been murdered at the hands of weaponry that our U.S. taxpayer money has unfortunately funded. So the conversation was very clear that we need to have a serious framework for us to say the United States should lead with moral clarity and fight for peace, and that we are not going to engage about this in any sense through electoral politics. Palestinian life should not be measured simply in poll numbers, but on the basis of their humanity. And that's what we reiterated to them. And anytime there's an opportunity to engage to help shift policy, we're going to try to do that. And that was what yesterday's attempt was. And now the ball is in the president's court and the White House's court to see what they will do after hearing our concerns. They can no longer say, well, we didn't know. We had very robust, very frank discussions with them, and they know where we stand. And now the question is, are they going to heed the call of their constituents and do something that a majority of Americans and Democrats support in demanding for a ceasefire and an end to the violence?
Michigan is a key swing state, and the Arab American and Muslim community is key to the votes for President Biden. You're part of a larger effort to vote uncommitted in the February primary in Michigan. Can you explain why you've made that decision? And if you addressed this yesterday with Biden administration officials?
Well, we made it very clear with them that there would be no engagement on electoral politics at this moment, and we were not going to entertain that. But as far as February 27th, rather, for the Michigan presidential primary, we are going to remain uncommitted. And the reason why we're doing that is because we need to let the White House know that they have an opportunity in this moment to earn the votes. As an elected official, I can tell you, when I run for office, I don't say, well, the other guy's worse than me. I give them a message and a platform for why I'm running. And we expect the White House and President Biden to do the same. And the expectation is we are letting him know from now, it's February, the election is in November, but we are letting him know now that we are uncommitted to his presidency until we see some changes in the policies that have affected both Americans here and so many abroad, as well as their families in the Gaza Strip.
Well, I'd like to bring in Leila Al-Abid, a Palestinian-American community organizer from Dearborn, Michigan, and a leader of the Listen to Mission campaign, which is urging constituents to cast a vote for uncommitted on Michigan's February 27th primary election in protest against President Biden's ongoing support for Israel's war on Gaza. Al-Abid is also the younger sister of Congressmember Rashida Tlaib, the only Palestinian-American member of Congress. Leila Al-Abid, welcome to Democracy Now! If you could begin by explaining why you decided to lead this campaign.
Well, personally, as a Palestinian American and somebody who, from the age of 12, saw the power of electoral politics within our Arab American and Muslim community, I knew that I wanted to be part of something that could possibly affect change. And the Uncommitted campaign in Michigan is part of a larger anti-movement, anti-war movement across the country, and we're focused on ending a war and stopping the military funding that supports genocide.
Well, I'd like to turn to comments that President Biden made while speaking at the White House last night after he addressed the special counsel's report on his handling of classified information. Biden responded to a question on Israel's assault on Gaza.
I'm of the view, as you know, that the conduct of the response in Gaza, in the Gaza Strip, has been over the top.
Leila Al-Abid, if you could respond to what President Biden said and what you hope will come out of this campaign.
That was his comments were still not a call for a ceasefire or for the reevaluation of military aid to Israel that is committing a genocide and an ethnic cleansing of Palestinians in Gaza. And until that happens, we cannot trust Biden and we cannot commit our votes to him.
Let's put the question to State Representative Abraham Ayash. If you can respond to what the Biden administration is now saying, President Biden, Tony Blinken, just back from his Mideast trip, are not calling for a ceasefire, but Blinken's talking about a pause, but they are warning Netanyahu about a ground assault on Rafah. Can you talk about the significance of this? I mean, the area you come from in Michigan, and Leila coming from Dearborn, one of the largest Arab American communities in the United States. You represent, State Representative Ash, so many, people who have family in Gaza right now. What that kind of ground assault would mean?
It would be devastating, one, for the people, but I think more importantly, I think the broader conversation is we need to make sure that if this happens, that the American people are very aware of what is going to be the message in November. But we are going to keep having that conversation and letting them know. But at this point, it's clear to them that we have made it our mission and our message that where we stand on this is very clear. We are a community that is demanding peace, and we expect it to be that way.
Representative Abraham Ayash, second-ranking Democrat in the Michigan House, thank you so much for joining us. And Leila Al-Abid, Palestinian-American community organizer from Dearborn, Michigan. When we come back, can Donald Trump be barred from running for president for engaging in an insurrection? That's the case before the Supreme Court. We'll speak with the nation's justice correspondent, Ellie Mistel. nowhere fast by girls at our best. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Nermeen Sheikh, joined by Amy Goodman. The U.S. Supreme Court heard oral arguments in a historic case Thursday to determine if Republican presidential frontrunner Donald Trump is eligible to stay on the ballot for the 2024 election. The justices are reviewing a decision by Colorado's High Court that found Section 3 of the 14th Amendment of the Constitution makes Trump ineligible to run for office because he engaged in an insurrection on January 6, 2021. A ruling would come within weeks. Before a packed courtroom, both liberal and conservative judges expressed skepticism over Colorado's case. This is liberal Justice Sonia Sotomayor.
I think that the question that you have to confront is why a single state should decide who gets to be president of the United States. In other words, you know, this question of whether a former president is disqualified for insurrection to be president again is, you know, just say it. It sounds awfully national to me. So whatever means there are to enforce it would suggest that they have to be federal, national means.
Meanwhile, liberal Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson appeared to agree with Trump's lawyer, Jonathan Mitchell's argument that the 14th Amendment's disqualification provision does not apply to all insurrectionists, but only to people who swore to support the Constitution as an officer of the United States, which does not include the president.
So the first argument is we have a list of offices that a person is barred from holding, right, under your theory or under the language of, and we see it begins with senator, representative, elector of president and vice president, and all other civil or military officers.
Offices under the United States.
Offices under the United States. But the word president or vice president does not appear specifically in that list. So I guess I'm trying to understand, are you giving up that argument? And if so, why?
No, we're not giving it up at all. You're right. The president and the vice president are not specifically listed. But the Anderson litigants claim that they are encompassed within the meaning of the phrase office under the United States.
And do you agree that the framers would have put such a high and significant and important office, sort of smuggled it in through that catch-all phrase?
We don't agree at all. That's why we're still making the argument.
That's Trump's lawyer, Jonathan Mitchell, questioned Thursday by Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson. And this is conservative Justice Brett Kavanaugh challenging Colorado's attorney, Jason Murray.
Last question. In trying to figure out what Section 3 means, and kind of to the extent it's elusive language or vague language, what about the idea that we should think about democracy, think about the right of the people to elect candidates of their choice, of letting the people decide? Because your position has the effect of disenfranchising voters to a significant degree.
This case illustrates the danger of refusing to apply Section 3 as written, because the reason we're here is that President Trump tried to disenfranchise 80 million Americans who voted against him, and the Constitution doesn't require that he be given another chance.
For more on this and other cases Trump is facing, we're joined by Eli Mistal, the nation's justice correspondent. His new piece is headlined, "The Supreme Court is Not Going to Save Us from Donald Trump." He's the author of Allow Me to Retort, A Black Guy's Guide to the Constitution. Welcome back to Democracy Now!, Eli. If you could just begin by responding to yesterday's oral arguments.
Yeah, it was a disaster. Apparently, the Constitution does not matter if it makes Republicans sad. The idea, and it's so important that you guys, I think, earlier highlighted the Bolsonaro story, right? Because look at what Brazil is doing when their former president threatened their government, right? They took my man's passport away, right? That's not what we do here, apparently. We don't defend ourselves, apparently. And yesterday's Supreme Court argument involved nine justices, three appointed by Republican presidents.